into this program is intended for a blind or print-impaired audience. Sorry about the strange fade out there. We're having some technical difficulties, evidently. Michael Blakely here with Religion in the News. For the next 28-odd minutes, I'll be reading articles from various news services on the subject of religion. From The Economist, first of March 16th, Orthodoxy, Homosexuality, and Hate. Gay rights activists lament the acquittal of a homophobic Greek bishop. There is little charity in the views of Metropolitan Ambrosios of Kalavrita. In many parts of Europe, socially conservative religious leaders complain that they cannot express their faith's traditional teaching on homosexuality without running the risk of persecution under equality or hate crime legislation. They cite the case of Akka Green, a Swedish Pentecost pastor who was sentenced to a month in jail, later overturned on appeal, after he called homosexuality a tumor on society. In Britain, police went through the early stages of a criminal investigation after Sir Iqbal Sakrini, a prominent Muslim leader, called homosexuality not acceptable and harmful. In 2016, a Christian street preacher in the Scottish town of Irvine spent a night in a police cell but was later acquitted of all charges after getting into an argument with a young man about the implication of the Genesis story for sexual behavior. In Greece, however, things seem to be moving in the other direction. To the intense dismay of secular human rights campaigners and gay rights activists, a famously sharp-tongued bishop has just been acquitted on charges of stirring up hatred and prejudice. The charges were prompted by an internet posting in 2015 when Greece's parliament was in the process of giving legal status to same-sex unions. Among other things, Metropolitan Ambrosios of Kalavrita wrote, "Do not go near them. Do not listen to them. Do not trust them. They are the damned members of society. It is impermissible for some disgraced members of society to defend publicly the passions that touch their souls. Spit on these disgraced people. Renounce them. They are monstrosities of nature. They are psychically and spiritually unwell. They are people with a mental disturbance. They are three times worse and more dangerous than those who live in mental asylums." In a tense hearing lasting nearly 9 hours in the small town of Agion, leading Greek human rights campaigners and academics gave evidence for the prosecution. Nikos Alivitsatos, a constitutional law professor, said the bishop's vocabulary was, quote, "the language of Hitler, the language we encounter in a regime of Ayatollahs." He said the bishop had brought embarrassment to Greece with his extreme positions, for example by saying that non-religious marriage was the moral equivalent of prostitution. The prosecution was brought at the behest of 8 leading gay rights activists who testified that the bishop's attack had compounded their feelings of insecurity and social exclusion. The bishop himself seemed little concerned by perceptions of bigotry or intemperance. At one point during the hearing, he said, quote, "Spitting on them is the least of it. If I had a gun and I was permitted by the law, I would use it and we would finish things off." He described fellow bishops who had spoken in somewhat more charitable terms about gay people as, quote, "betrayers of orthodoxy." But the bishop's defense team, in between making some anti-gay jibes at the witnesses, insisted that comments by their client that seemed to attack gay people were in fact directed at the politicians who were voting for civil partnerships. This rather flimsy line of argument was accepted, and a representative of the State Prosecution Service urged acquittal, and the recommendation was followed. The dismay over the affair went beyond Greece. Another Orthodox bishop, called Ambrosios, recently retired from the Diocese of Helsinki, said he found it shocking to hear of his fellow hierarch's outburst. The Finnish cleric told Erasmus that the Greek prelate's opinions contradict the Church's idealistic view of humanity. In the Orthodox Christian understanding, every human being has been made in the image of God, both gays and homosexuals, male and female. And from the Religion News Service now of March 16th, Guam Archbishop Anthony Aperon, who was accused of sexually abusing young men, has been found guilty of some of the charges against him by a Vatican tribunal, which removed him from office and exiled him from the island. He retains the right to an appeal. The 5-judge Apostolic Tribunal of the Vatican's Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith announced the verdict on Friday, but did not specify which allegations the 72-year-old archbishop had been found guilty of, according to the National Catholic Reporter. Pope Francis placed Aperon, a Guam native, on leave in June 2016 after accusations emerged that the archbishop had abused young men throughout the 1960s and 70s. Aperon had led the island's diocese since 1986. Accusations came from former altar boys who said Aperon sexually abused or raped them when he was a parish priest in the 1970s. The most recent charge emerged in January 2018 when Aperon's own nephew accused the cleric of raping him in the chancery bathroom in or around 1989 or 1990, when Aperon was already an archbishop. Aperon, who was never criminally charged by civil authorities in Guam, has denied all the allegations. U.S. Cardinal Raymond L. Burke, a prominent canon lawyer, was the presiding judge in the investigation. The tiny island has been rocked in recent years by mounting allegations of sexual abuse within the Catholic Church there. In addition to the charges against Aperon, 13 parish priests, a Catholic schoolteacher, and a school janitor have all been accused of sexual abuse in Guam, according to a 2017 investigation by the Pacific Daily News. The investigative team unearthed nearly 100 lawsuits alleging the abuse of children over the course of nearly 4 decades. Coadjutor Archbishop Michael Burns, a former auxiliary bishop of Detroit, is primed to replace Aperon in the diocese if the conviction holds. But Aperon retains the right to appeal the ruling, during which the penalties against him are suspended. And from the U.S. News and World Report now of March 13th, 5 years into his papacy, Pope Francis's favorability rating remains nearly unchanged. According to a recent Pew Research Center report, 84% of Roman Catholics have a favorable opinion of the Pope, down only 1 percentage point from the end of his election year. But among Catholic Republicans, it's a different story. His favorability ratings have dropped by 11 percentage points since 2014, when 9 in 10 Catholic Republicans had a favorable view of the Pope. More than half of Catholic Republicans in the Pew survey say Francis is, quote, too liberal, and only 37% that he represents a major change for the better. Throughout his papacy, Francis has been recognized for his more liberal views regarding some of the nation's most contested topics, from climate change to immigration and divorce. While some conservatives might not agree with his stances, the Catholic community's views as a whole seem to be shifting with him. First, homosexuality. The Pope made headlines in 2013 when he expressed a more open stance on homosexuality than his predecessor, Pope Benedict XVI. If someone is gay and he searches for the Lord and has good will, who am I to judge? Francis said in response to a question about the supposed gay lobby. And the Pope's position is reflected by Catholics' evolving views on same-sex marriage. More than two-thirds of U.S. Catholics say they favor same-sex marriage, compared with 54% in 2012, according to the Pew report. Still, 44% say Francis has only done a little to make the Catholic Church more accepting of homosexuality. And second, climate change. Francis has taken a firm stance on climate change, calling on people to accept scientific evidence and preserve the environment. When President Donald Trump visited the Vatican in 2017, the Pope presented him with a copy of his 2015 encyclical letter, Laudato Si, which expresses these opinions. Top Vatican officials even asked Trump not to withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord. A year after the release of Laudato Si, 60% of Catholics agreed that temperatures are getting warmer in response to higher concentrations of heat-trapping gases, and that this is largely a result of human activity. A slightly lower share, 58%, of all U.S. adults agreed with those statements, according to the Georgetown University poll. And third, abortion. In another groundbreaking move, Francis announced in 2016 that priests can grant absolution for abortion. Though he considers abortion a grave sin, he said, "There is no sin that God's mercy cannot reach and wipe away when it finds a repentant heart seeking to be reconciled with the Father. Catholics' views on abortion haven't changed as drastically as those on homosexuality, but the percentage of those who say abortion should be illegal in all or most cases jumped by 4 percentage points to reach 53% in 2017. And then fourth, divorce. Francis has given Catholics, who are civilly divorced but cannot remarry in the eyes of the Church without an annulment, a second chance at marriage with a streamlined annulment process. Despite Francis's efforts, 30% of Catholics, 38% rather, of Catholics said they would like to see the Pope do more in the area of divorce and remarriage. Only 17% said they don't want him to do more or would like him to do less in the Pew poll. And then atheism. The Pope has preached acceptance throughout his papacy, even saying that those who do not believe in God can reach heaven if they lead good lives. In a May 2013 homily, Francis didn't mince words. Quote, "The Lord has redeemed all of us with the blood of Christ, all of us, not just Catholics, everyone, Father the atheists, even the atheists, everyone." To the Guardian now of March 17th. There's a wild card option that some Israeli Jews have started using when they can't find a restaurant with a kosher certificate. Vegan food. Fresh fruits, vegetables, and grains are, by most accounts, naturally kosher, and as the mixing of dairy and meat is forbidden in Judaism, a safe choice is to eat somewhere that avoids both. A growing religious zeal for veganism has been further fostered by rabbis who question whether the faithful should eat animals at all, especially under modern farming methods considered inhumane. Animal abuse is explicitly forbidden in the Bible. "The world has changed. We don't have a choice. We must become vegan," says religious scholar Asa Kesar, a figurehead of the Campaign for Jewish Veganism. "There is no such thing as kosher meat." Israel's vegan movement has found that alongside its mostly secular progressive base, members from more pious sections of society are also joining its ranks and making the country one of the easiest places to be vegan. There was signed a declaration urging Jews to choose veganism, saying it was a contradiction to claim that products made, quote, "through a process that involves inordinate cruelty and barbarity toward human life or animal life, can truly be considered kosher in our world. The Garden of Eden, which was the ideal society, was a vegetarian society. Adam and Eve were vegans," said Rabbi David Rosen, former chief rabbi of Ireland, in a statement. From a tiny faction of outliers just 5 years ago, Israeli vegans now say they make up 5% of the country's population, a higher percentage than anywhere else in the world. An estimated 500 restaurants are vegan or have substantial plant-based dishes on their menus. Tel Aviv is often referred to as the world's vegan capital, while Domino's Israel branch was the first to offer animal product-free pizza, and most coffee chains have vegan options. "Veganism is almost mainstream," said Ori Shavit, a consultant for Israeli restaurants hoping to cater to the growing camp. "Ideas spread fast in a country of 8 million. Judaism has helped too," she says, "because the kosher diet means Jews, even many secular ones, have a culture of checking what is in their food. Even if I'm not keeping kosher, I know what it means, and I know how to keep kosher. We're used to looking at the label. We're used to separating dairy from meat," she said. "It's the idea of not eating automatically. This is something that is very helpful when you come to embrace the vegan diet." Religious sections of society, even if they aren't vegan, provide a vast market for businesses selling vegan products. For example, when eating a burger, it would not be kosher to drink a glass of milk, so many Israelis buy alternatives. And these kind of non-dairy, non-meat foods are labeled as parveh, or and are well-stocked. Even small corner shops sell cartons of almond and rice milk. Parveh products are mostly vegan, although sometimes they include eggs. "The consumer audience is actually very big because it touches almost every family. That can encourage veganism. It makes veganism easier, so it's a win-win situation," said Shavit. "Practicing Jews are becoming increasingly aware of veganism," Shavit says. She ran a pop-up restaurant recently that had no official kosher certificate, but would often see Jews wearing skull caps, usually signifying that they're Orthodox, eating there. Kesar wants more people to becoming vegan for religious reasons. He has lectured in synagogues around the country and hung posters promoting veganism in ultra-Orthodox neighborhoods. He argues that Jewish teaching imposed so many onerous rules on meat consumption because the intent is to stop the practice altogether. The Torah, the Bible, does not want people to eat meat. We have maybe 1,000 rules about meat in Judaism. Jewish law provides detailed instructions about how animals should be kept and slaughtered, down to the precise motion of the knife during the killing. It's forbidden to slaughter an animal in front of another, such as is practiced in many poultry farms. Consuming blood is prohibited, and certain parts of the animal are not kosher, including parts of the fat and the sciatic nerve. Many Jews won't eat a sirloin steak because of its proximity to that nerve. When you cannot keep these rules, and Kesar says nobody can, you have one option left, veganism. Back to the Economist now of March 14th. Maple leaves and mezuzahs. Understanding Canada's Jews. In Canada, Jewish identity is hard to measure but still strong. To get a sense of the ambivalence and also the residual strength of Jewish identity in Canada, meet Itamar Shani and his business partner Rotem Tal, who run a vegan restaurant in Vancouver. Mr. Shani grew up in an Orthodox Jewish household in Israel, but proved insufficiently devout to satisfy his family. Mr. Tal likes the teaching of Buddhism, but the tattoo on his forearm speaks of the Kabbalah, Jewish mysticism, and he wears a Star of David on a beaded necklace. The food they serve may not be classic kosher cuisine, but there's plenty of Israeli-style hummus. Their establishment attracts young Jews who are not especially religious but want some connection with their heritage. And like those restaurateurs and their clients, many Canadians of Jewish origin sit somewhere on a spectrum between a full embrace of their forebears' identity and faith and assimilation into the country's mainstream culture. On the West Coast, in particular, this allows for mix-and-match experimentation that makes the size and profile of the Canadian Jewish community hard to assess. The most recent Canadian census shows an astonishing decline in the number of self-identified Jews from 309,000 in 2011 to 143,000 in 2016. This seems like an unbelievable development, but there's in fact a simple explanation. In both surveys, Statistics Canada, a government agency, asked respondents to give their ethnic or cultural origin and offered a long list of possible answers. Jewish was among the suggested options in the first census, but not in the second one. So, presumably, many Jews simply identified themselves by the country where they or their forebears had lived most recently. A campaign has started for a Jewish option in the 2021 census. Two social scientists, Robert Brim of the University of Toronto and Rhonda Lenton of York University, are now embarking on a wide-ranging study that they hope will provide a more accurate picture. It will ask up to 80 questions about matters such as child-rearing, attitudes toward Israel, and experience of anti-Semitism. In some ways, it will be Canada's answer to an influential study of American Jews from 2013 that found 22% of self-identified Jews and 32% of those born after 1980 professed no religion. As with the United States, Canada's Jewish population began growing in the late 19th century because of pogroms and turmoil in Eastern Europe. One stereotype holds that at least in the eastern provinces, Canada's Jews stayed closer to their Old World roots than American ones. The survey will test that and also look at whether migration to the West is a path out of active Judaism. Mr. Brim has said he is prepared to find some extremes of assimilation and religious devotion. Ms. Lenton says they wanted to discover whether, for Jews in general, Canada lives up to its self-image as a mosaic, a land where different groups keep their identity, as opposed to the American melting pot, where there is pressure to assimilate. The survey sponsors have also cited more specific concerns. Jewish leaders in Toronto want to know more about recent-ish arrivals from Russia, who were classified as Jewish under the Soviet system, but may have little connection to faith. Their counterparts in Montreal are concerned about the numbers migrating to the Pacific. But as is noted by Richard Menzies of the University of British Columbia, the Pacific community's growth, which started in the 1980s, is not merely a phenomenon of footloose Canadians. Vancouver's freewheeling atmosphere also attracts people of Jewish origin from other places like South Africa. Among the survey's starting points is an estimate by community leaders that around 400,000 Jews live in Canada. That estimate amounts to less than 2% of the total Canadian population, but it would give Canada the world's fourth largest community after Israel, America, and France. Numbers may have been boosted recently by Francophone Jews moving from Europe to Quebec, and possibly by some American Jews moving north. About half the Canadian total are thought to live in the Toronto area, and a quarter in Montreal. British Columbia's total comes to less than 10%. The realities of Judaism on Canada's west coast are a confusing mixture. Lisa Oppenheim, an arts educator, says that when she moved to Vancouver from Calgary, neighbors were surprised by the mezuzah or Hebrew scroll she affixed to her door. Some were Jewish and told her that they were nervous about proclaiming their identity. They asked me, "Wasn't I afraid?" she recalls. "I learned there are still people here in Canada who are scared to say they're Jews." Joshua Sorin, an accountant, notes that economic pressures often force Jews to move to outer suburbs of Vancouver with no synagogues. This is an easy place not to be Jewish, as he puts it. Rabbi Shmiluk Yeshayahu, who moved to Vancouver from Israel 15 years ago, has had a more positive experience. At first, he had to contact dozens of people to persuade them to dine and pray at his home, and only seven, less than the 10-strong quorum for a public act of prayer, accepted his first invitation. But now his Friday evening services bring in up to 100 young adults, as well as older people and children. He agrees that Jews can lose their identity in Vancouver, a colder place in several senses than Israel, but people have responded well to the collective warmth of the community he has built up. One of the characteristics of a spectrum is that you can move along it in either direction. And back to the Religion News Service now of March 14th. A brief history of Stephen Hawking's atheism. Say the words British, scientist, and atheist, and the first person to come to mind probably isn't Stephen Hawking. But while Hawking, who the theoretical physicist who died March 14th at age 76, was certainly overshadowed in the atheist department by his countryman, the evolutionary biologist and atheist activist Richard Dawkins, Hawking's atheism was more of a slow simmer than Dawkins' explosive ire. Quote, "What could define God is thinking of God as the embodiment of the laws of nature. However, this is not what most people would think of that God," Hawking told Diane Sawyer in 2010. "They make a human-like being with whom one can have a personal relationship. And when you look at the vast size of the universe and how insignificant and accidental human life is, that seems most impossible." One reason Hawking's atheism was less well-known was that he seemed to fudge the question of God's existence for years. In his 1988 seminal bestseller, A Brief History of Time, he wrote, "The whole history of science has been the gradual realization that events do not happen in an arbitrary manner, but that they reflect a certain underlying order, which may or may not be divinely inspired." Later in the book, he writes of the quest for a unifying theory of the universe, quote, "It would be the ultimate triumph of human reason, for then we should know the mind of God." Some saw those statements as proof that Hawking had private religious beliefs. And he fed that idea with a few statements over the years. Quote, "The laws may have been decreed by God," he told Reuters in 2007, "but God does not intervene to break the laws." And even entitled a 2005 book, "God Created the Integers." He also went to the Vatican and met briefly with then-Pope Benedict XVI in 2008. Then, in 2010, with the publication of The Grand Design, Hawking seemed to have begun a sort of atheist striptease, slowly revealing his non-belief. Quote, "Because there is a law such as gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. said he and co-author Leonard Mlodinow, right? Spontaneous creation is the reason there is something rather than nothing, why the universe exists, why we exist. It is not necessary to invoke God to light the blue touch paper and set the universe going. And within a year, Hawking said in a Discovery Channel documentary, "We are each free to believe what we want, and it is my view that the simplest explanation is that there is no God. No one created the universe, and no one directs our fates." And just in case that wasn't clear enough, Hawking dropped the last veil in a 2014 interview with the Spanish newspaper El Mundo. "What I meant by we would know the mind of God is we would know everything that God would know if there was a God, which there isn't. I'm an atheist." After his death, some atheists remarked that Hawking's outlook on having just this one life was marked for him by debilitating Lou Gehrig's disease, fortified their own lack of belief. Hawking had to aggressively face his own mortality every single day. It would have been understandable for him to abandon evidential reasoning and fall into the old adage that there are no atheists in a foxhole, said Liana Brindan, an atheist, in an online magazine, Quartz. Instead, he continued to approach his stance on religion with scientific, evidence-based reasoning. Now to the Associated Press of March 17th. Streets are deserted and an airport closes for Bali's Day of Silence. Indonesia's normally bustling Bali has shut down social media, turned away flights, and shuttered all shops for a Day of Silence that marks the new year on the predominantly Hindu island. Nyepi began at 6 a.m. on Saturday, emptying streets and beaches for 24 hours, except for special patrols to ensure that silence is observed. This year, for the first time, phone companies have agreed to turn off the mobile internet on the island that's home to more than 4 million people. Aside from no Facebook, Instagram, or instant messaging apps, television and radio broadcasts cease, and Balinese stay indoors, covering the windows and not even turning on a light, for the day of reflection that is the most sacred in Balinese Hinduism. Nyepi is the time for us to wash our hearts and minds of bad thoughts and deeds, plead with God to purify us, human beings and the universe, said Kadik Chattini, a Bali tour guide. Not everyone was happy with the decision to disrupt internet access, saying it was going too far and an inconvenience for tourists and non-Hindu residents of Bali, but others welcomed it. "It will certainly provide a quieter atmosphere so that we can focus and concentrate on perfecting our meditation and prayers," said Komang Suda, a resident of Desbasar, a Bali provincial capital. "The decision also really helps us in disciplining our teenagers, who sometimes sneak off to play with their gadgets during Nyepi," he said. The night before Nyepi is marked by noisy Ogo Ogo processions of giant scary figures representing evil spirits. Sounds like Day of the Dead. Well, that's all we have of the time we have now for religion in the news. This has been Michael Blakely. I'll talk to you later.